And welcome back, everyone, to the Star Court Lounge. I realize it has been quite the delay or break from the prior episode with regards to the Elden Ring review. And today, we're treading into similar territory in that we are having a chat and review about 2022's The Batman. The Batman was directed by Matt Reeves and starred a number of big name actors in very high profile crucial roles to the film. Kind of running down the list, your big players are Robert Pattinson as the titular Batman / Bruce Wayne, Andy Serkis, who everyone knows and loves from great classics like The Lord of the Rings and the Planet of the Apes trilogy, which Matt Reeves also directed. He plays our wonderful British butler, Alfred. Jeffrey Wright plays, in this particular movie, a Lieutenant James Gordon. Paul Dano, the Riddler, our predominant primary villain of this film. Colin Farrell makes an appearance as an unrecognizable individual playing Osborne Cobblepot, the Penguin. Zoe Kravitz as Selina Kyle / Catwoman. And an unexpected one, John Turturro as this movie's Carmine Falcone or Falcone. They are kind of inconsistent on the pronunciation of that name. They generally fall on it being Falcone, but you do get the occasional Falcone with that kind of hard Y slip on in there. So I found that kind of intriguing, that kind of inconsistency. But that aside, 2022's The Batman is a bit of a departure from prior cinematic Batman endeavors. Predominantly in that this is the first of kind of a refresh or reboot coming off of the coattails of the Snyderverse Batfleck from Justice League and Batman vs. Superman. But this is not an origin story of sorts. We are coming into the story 2 years into Bruce being Batman. So he's established, but still learning the ropes. This is very personal for him. Coming from the classic, his parents were murdered, but with a twist, which we'll get into a little bit later. I have, over the course of my note-taking, watched this film 3 times and have enjoyed it thoroughly each time. Now, the film itself is a runtime of about 3 hours, which nowadays seems like it's becoming the standard bearer for movie runtimes, especially if you want something that's weighty and legitimate and packs some sort of symbolic punch. But I felt like the film was very well paced, and I didn't really feel like the 3 hours, even on subsequent watches, was that bad. It didn't feel like a 3-hour movie, especially seeing as I first watched it the day it released on HBO Max, and then watched it again the day after, and then more recently I watched it today as of recording. And each time, again, it was well paced and didn't feel like it was dragging along or had any unnecessary filler. that it was putting in to pad its time, which I greatly appreciated, because a lesser movie would more than certainly do that. But I feel like a lesser movie wouldn't end up where this film is. So we find ourselves, like I mentioned, 2 years into Batman's tenure, his reign of terror over the Knights of Gotham and the criminals and seedy element that Gotham inhabits. And we find ourselves opening on a point of view shot, which I found very interesting. It was at first a little confusing, because you get your title, or rather your WB Pictures logo, you get the title, and then it cuts to a point of view shot through like a set of binoculars with heavy breathing and the song Ave Maria playing. And you're witnessing an individual in an office of some sort talking on a phone. And then, no, scratch that. You're witnessing someone dressed as a ninja kind of playing around or doing something in an office. So at first I was thinking, like, alright, is this like, are we taking like a weird turn where there's like ninjas committing like thefts and stuff like that? And then an individual comes in who appears to be larger and then is, and I'm putting this in air quotes, attacked and like falls to the ground. I'm like, oh, okay, we're getting to the point quick. And it turns out it's all just a father and son. It is a son dressed as a ninja who is playing around with his dad, and his dad is playing around with his kid, because it's Halloween, and this is his costume. After that, we cut to a skylight, raining, heavy rain at night with dark orange, warm lights kind of illuminating the interior of this mansion. And on the TV is kind of what is setting up one of the main driving points or through lines for a lot of the motivations for our villain, who is going to be introduced here very, very soon. And on the TV is a political debate between two mayoral candidates. You have your incumbent and the young challenger debating the merits of new blood in office and progressivism, and the incumbent continues to talk about how under his tenure and his incumbency, Gotham City has seen the biggest drug bust in city and police history. And I'm throwing this in now after I caught on to it in my second and third and other subsequent watches and highlights of other reviews that I've listened to. But they bring up the renewal, which was something that Bruce's parents had set up back in the day as a way of getting money into the hands of those that need it and could benefit from it. And that plays a major part in the Riddler's grievances and pursuit for what he sees as justice. And one of the key things that is brought up in this, and it's kind of just a throwaway, is that Gotham City, which is very analogous to a New York City in this particular world, has a seawall because presumably it is positioned below sea level, and the seawall is there to protect its citizens and its streets and businesses and everything from an encroachment of the sea to reclaim its territory. And it's mentioned that the seawall is predominantly funded through this renewal program, which, if you're not really paying attention, don't think too much about it, you kind of miss. But that comes into play later down the line, like I mentioned in the third act. We'll kind of come back to that. And then during this scene, you see who we learn to be the incumbent mayor watching this debate and chatting with one of his advisors about his declining polling numbers. During this, we are introduced to the villain of this film, the Riddler. His introduction is that of a serial killer, for lack of a better word. He was heavily inspired by the likes of Zodiac and BTK, and he's standing in the mayoral house, illuminated by the TV's glow, silent, keeping track of the mayor as the mayor paces back and forth discussing his declining poll numbers. And after the phone call ends with his advisor is when the Riddler strikes. And I feel like in other movies, it would likely, as the Riddler attacks and commits his crime against the mayor, it would cut away, and then we'd come back to the aftermath. But what I think this film does great with its 3-hour runtime is it gives moments more time to shine. So rather than cut away, we see the full brutality of this attack. We see the Riddler club the mayor over the head with some sort of implement and repeatedly hit him over the head on the ground. So hard, in fact, that the implement flies free of his hand and lands scattering across the floor several feet away. And from this alone, you can already tell that it's going to be a significantly different sort of Batman. Not a ninja Batman like the Nolan, which are great films. It's not a grandiose kind of world cataclysm event type of situation like you would find in the Justice League Snyder films. It's not a, I don't know how to really describe the Burton Schumacher stuff outside of just kind of weird, not in a bad way, but just by comparison, they're more fantastical. But this one is definitely setting itself up to be a much more almost intimate type of experience, with how it's hanging on moments, and how it's just letting things breathe and exist on film to give you this experience. And then you see the Riddler begin to take duct tape, and we later learn that that is used to bind the face of the mayor. Once he first rips his piece of duct tape, it cuts away, and we get a monologue, which, historically hasn't always fared well in cinema. Implementations like that of Blade Runner were widely panned by both critics and the actors providing reciting. But this one was very well done, and it helps you to understand, and it helps to lean more into the atmosphere and tone and everything that the director, Matt Reeves, and crew are attempting, and in my opinion, successfully set up. The idea is that it's a noir, so it's kind of going back to the roots of Batman, 1939 detective, hard-boiled detective noir type style, which is further bolstered by Batman's surprisingly not necessarily overt to the public, but overt to Gotham PD, how blatant he is at actually coming onto a crime scene with the cops, and like helping them sort of deduce and solve these crimes and mysteries. And we get the impression that this isn't the first rodeo between him and Gordon, but that is getting ahead of us. And during this monologue, we kind of get an idea and are able to peer into Bruce's psyche about how he feels the city has gone, and how he feels that he is a nocturnal animal who's got to push himself, and that he doesn't even know if he's making a difference. And during this, he's talking about how criminals fear that he's lurking in the shadows, but he's in fact the shadows. And then it, after that, ends kind of concluding on whether or not he's actually making a difference, as it kind of intercuts between different crimes being committed and perpetuated against different institutions. Like there's an attack against some sort of, it looks like a bank, being graffitied, and arson being committed against it with like a Molotov cocktail, and like a robbery at a convenience store and stuff. And each one kind of intercuts with the criminals or the perpetuators looking into dark alleys, and like it leaves them wondering, but it also leaves you as the audience wondering. It's like, all right, is Batman going to come out of these shadows, and is he going to stop these criminals? But the one that he ends up coming out of is in relation to a third one on a train with a bunch of gang members who are faces are painted white and everything, going over one of their latest initiations or attacks on one of the members' cell phones, where they ran up to a bystander of some sort and just punched them. And they kind of zero in and narrow in on one of the commuters. And as the commuter gets off the train, they follow suit and pin him against a wall, and are trying to get one of their newer initiates to punch him, knock him out, and be inducted into their demented brotherhood. And as they're kind of getting him, convincing him to do so, you hear some rattling off in the background, metal on metal and stuff, and then you hear slow, heavy footfalls. And they all kind of stop, and it cuts to like a dark hallway, pitch black, and all you hear is heavy boot falls on wet, hard floor. And it gives you a very ominous horror type of feel. Which I think one of my favorite scenes from Batman versus Superman was the horror elements of the, it's been a while since I saw the movie, of the first introduction of Batman with the Gotham cops going through that abandoned building, and then they pan up with their lights and you see him just kind of like suction cup to the wall, almost like the Grinch in the Mail Room and the Ron Howard Grinch movie. And then like he very quickly like horror monster scuttles across the wall or something like that and escapes. You get a similar idea, but not quite to that extent. You get more of like the slow plotting Jason Voorhees, Michael Myers. Like it's an inevitable force that's coming towards you. And you see him slowly appear out of the shadows as one of the main gang members attempts to do battle and is quickly and very, very brutally beat down. He is quickly disarmed of his like little machete looking thing, brought to the ground, and then for good measures, Batman just gives two massive blows to the man on the ground and then just stands up, and everyone's just like, oh, okay, so this is the Batman, like, all right, we're going to be fighting him, who's going to go in first? And they are all very quickly dispatched, but it's not like a very clean like martial arts like you'd see from a multi-adversarial combat or fight scene from like the Nolan and Christian Bale rendition, where he's very efficient, very clean, he kind of picks him apart. This Batman is very dirty. Some of the behind the scenes say that he's like a street fighter with different bits of MMA mixed in to kind of give it some groundedness, but it's very, he's not afraid to take some blows. Like, he's just a tank that, I mean, he takes multiple gunshots off of the chest, chest plate and his armor throughout the film, and just keeps on going like it doesn't really faze him, which is just like, for a criminal, that'd be terrifying. After dispatching these gangs, he looks up to see the bat signal, and that is where we cut to what I mentioned earlier, a very overt to the police Batman walking down the hall of the mayoral home, flanked on either side by just a line of officers trying to keep the scene secure at the murder of the mayor. And he walks up, trailing who we learned to be Gordon, to the very threshold into the living area where the crime was committed. And after some convincing from Gordon, the officer securing that doorway permit Batman in. And during this, we get to the idea and the setup that this is going to be a, beyond just the kind of noir influences thus far with the monologues, the heavy rains, and everything, but we get the cemented idea that this is a detective Batman. This isn't some grandiose, like, we're going to vaporize all the water in the city type of thing. This is, we are solving a murder that later becomes more murders. and trying to find and piece together the pattern and the reasoning behind them, which is very well done, and eventually starts to loop back around onto Bruce Wayne, further cementing the more intimate, personal story that this holds to all, well, maybe not necessarily all the characters, but especially between Riddler and Bruce Wayne, Batman. And it's kind of here that we start to get a much better look at Pattinson's Batsuit, which looks quite amazing. I was very skeptical at first about it in the, like, the screen tests early on in pre-production and stuff, but it's grown on me, especially with like how kind of cobbled together it is, and it very much fits into the style and aesthetic that they're going for in the detective noir, like the little collar around his mask that is part of his cape, to me was very reminiscent of like a trench coat kind of collar popped up to help shield your neck from like the rain that's downpouring in your corrupted cesspit of a city. And though I've never seen Seven, I've seen clips of it. It did give me some vibes from that film as well, which I believe Reeves said he was partly inspired by, as from an aesthetic and atmosphere point of view. But it definitely gave that kind of Gotham by Gaslight noir detective feel some legitimacy. And we get to see Batman doing what he's known for, being a detective and solving mysteries. Even seemingly kind of pointing out potentially missed evidence and things like that in the blood stain and scuff mark where the murder weapon had flown and hit the ground. And then kind of solving a cipher that was left for him by the Riddler in the form of a greeting card and a riddle. The gist of it being, what does a dead man do, or what does a dead liar do when he is dead? Or what does a liar do when he's dead? And the answer is that he lies still, implying that he lied in life, but he was part of a much greater machination of the city, covering up some sort of shadowy, shady deal, which is at the heart of the Riddler's grievances with the elite of Gotham, which at that point I was very, very much sold on the whole thing. I love a noir atmosphere. I love that detective feel. I love that murder mystery thriller genre a lot. It's just a very fascinating genre of film. And after kind of concluding there, we get to see Bruce still, he's still Batman, but not dressed as Batman, which is something that I was very interested in and kind of kept track of, is that there are many scenes, and it makes sense, where Bruce is patrolling or traveling throughout Gotham as Batman, not as Bruce Wayne, because Bruce Wayne, we find out, is very reclusive and very rarely makes any appearances. But he's in just street clothes, like blue-collar workers' clothes, driving on a motorcycle to blend in, which is very interesting, but makes sense, because like a dude riding around on a motorcycle in cape and bat cowl is gonna stand out quite a bit. And this first scene with the motorcycle and his street clothes with a Nirvana song playing in the background. One of the focus shifts, not from a storytelling perspective or anything, like from a purely cinematography based level, on the motorcycle mirror as it's all sort of blurred bokeh, depth of field, and it slowly shifts the focus so that clarity comes back through to the mirror and you see like lights and everything just kind of traveling past behind him. I'm like, wow, that was a beautiful shot, and we're going to be having very serious, like, this is going to be serious cinematography, and they aren't skimping. They are like, they're going all out. They're making this as best as they can. Like, they're going big. They aren't leaving anything on the table, which I appreciated. And like, this is setting us up for good stuff. This ends with Bruce getting back to Wayne Tower, not Wayne Manor. Wayne Tower, like a penthouse in the middle of the city with the Batcave being a abandoned subway tunnel. So I like that they keep familiar elements but have reinvented them and kind of flipped them a little bit to give them a bit of a twist and give it a modernization of some sort, but also it doesn't feel like it's very modern. It feels very timeless. I don't know. The alterations that they make, I feel, were done very well and don't distract. It's more of like, that's pretty cool. I wouldn't have thought of that or expected that. So very similar in idea to Bruce's penthouse in The Dark Knight, but rather than having his shipping container Batcave across city by the docks, it's just straight beneath the tower in an abandoned subway tunnel. Pretty awesome. And in his Batcave, we get to see several main things that I really, really, really liked. From like a Batman's gadget perspective, we see that he's got this really cool like contact lens video camera that he can then play back on like a device and then basically print screen grabs and screenshots of it on his Bat computer, which is pretty awesome. 'Cause as he's writing in his journal, which if you look closely, you'll notice some of the phrases and keywords flashed on screen from his monologue. We see that he's been keeping journals and observations of his nightly escapades as he finds that they blend all together, and sometimes he has to force himself to remember, which then feeds into why he's got this video camera contact lens and he's watching it back, so that way he can go back and observe and maybe see and find details that he missed the first go around, which is smart for a detective. But then we also get to meet Alfred, who kind of leads us to believe, or basically spells it out for us, that that Bruce is very reclusive, that Alfred's worried for him, that he's been letting his personal affairs with, or his business affairs with, like, Wayne Enterprise and everything like that slip and take a very, very far back burner from his Batman crusade. But the last thing that they kind of establish in this shot is that Bruce, like, has the eye makeup, like, very, it's been kind of memed on and everything, but like when you put a mask, the mask on, like very clearly the Bruce would have some sort of black eye makeup around his eyes for that to blend in with the cowl and the mask. Otherwise, his natural skin is going to show right through around his eye. And historically in the past, when they take off the bat mask, that essentially comes with it. When in reality, if it's makeup, it's not adhered or attached to the mask in any way. It's attached to his skin. So if you took the mask off, the makeup would remain. And that is exactly what they do with Robert Pattinson's Bruce. When he takes the mask off, you see the dark eye makeup just like running down his face from like sweat and rain and everything. And I thought that was a very good touch to kind of ground it a little bit more. Starting to move a little bit faster. Because, I mean, like I said, 3 hours of movie. With the help of Alfred, Bruce helps to decipher the rest of the cipher. Or decode the cipher left by the Riddler at the mayor's murder scene. And is brought to an underground parking garage. Housing a bunch of the mayor's cars where So he and Gordon go there and find in one of the cars a USB drive with the mayor's thumb attached to it, as the mayor's thumb was severed in the murder and attack. Gordon puts the thumb drive into his computer and finds that it is encrypted. And Batman suggests using the thumb to decrypt it. And sure enough, that does the trick. And a bunch of compromising photos of the mayor with various individuals at a known kind of mob hangout known as the Iceberg Lounge. Are sent out from Gordon's email to various news outlets, which I think Batman had a pretty good idea that something like that may happen, but at this point I don't think he really cares too much. Like, well, he trusts Gordon to an extent. He's not terribly concerned about how he's making an impact on him or what the actions will. The fallout of those actions and consequences will have. He's just very, very set on avenging his parents' murder, which we learn is unsolved to this point and occurred during a mayoral bid for his father, Thomas Wayne, which I found an interesting kind of alteration or change to. This scene also kind of sets up some of the dark humor and kind of puns present throughout the movie. For instance, with the USB drive, commonly referred to as a thumb drive, which I can assume you're probably seeing where this is going, but the thumb was kind of keychained or attached to this USB drive in the vehicle. And Gordon asks, like, what Batman found. Batman pulls it out. He's like, thumb drive. Which got a little bit of a chuckle out of me. I'm a fan for dark kind of pun humor like that. It gives it some levity where needed without really kind of getting too quippy and kind of Marvel humor-esque, which is always something I've had issues with. Works well for the Marvel films, but that's also very established tone and atmosphere, and you can go for darker films like Endgame and Infinity War and still have that quippiness, but you can't just put quippy kind of Marvel-style humor in every film and expect it to work. That was one of the big issues that I had with the original cut of Justice League. It's too out of place and not in character. Same with some of the stuff in some of the sequel trilogy Star Wars films, most notably in The Last Jedi with the opening scene and like the, oh, can you hear me? Like, is my, like the whole phone call type thing with Hux and Poe, that kind of irritated me just because it was very, it felt very forced, very Marvel humor in a context and area that it didn't need to be. Rant over. We get a lead to the Iceberg Lounge. And Batman basically beats his way into there, and we get to meet the Penguin, who, like mentioned at the start, is played by Colin Farrell. But if you didn't know that, he is very unrecognizable as the Penguin. They did a wonderful job on the prosthetics, and Farrell did a wonderful job acting and on his accent, because you wouldn't know he's Irish based on anything in this movie. And we get some further exposition to a point of some clues, and we get to meet or are introduced to who we find out to be Selina Kyle, who Batman follows to her apartment, and in a very similar scene to the start, we get another point of view shot through binoculars, but this time it's Bruce, kind of spying and getting the lay of the, getting a read on Selina. And the big thing this time, though, is that we do get some, what I would say, like third person perspective shots of sorts, or like third person omnipotent, where the camera's like facing or like very tight in on Bruce's face, and you definitely see that it's him looking through the binoculars, so it doesn't leave us any doubt that it's him versus the Riddler. And it's very, the music that's in this is very like kind of almost sensual. It's kind of got like a sexy undertone. It's very like sly. Creates a, like an intimacy of some sort there. And we essentially see that Selina has a roommate of some sort, and then she changes into her cat suit and leaves. This prompts Bruce to follow her on his motorcycle, following her motorcycle, and we see Selina come through the skylight and break into of the mayoral home, and we learn that she's getting a passport for her roommate friend, and Batman comes in at the tail end of that, no pun intended on that, after she opens up the safe and gets the passport, and a short little scuffle ensues. And during this, like, a Gotham officer enters into the room, and they quickly have to kind of put their fight on hold. Batman kind of subduing her in, like, a rear hug of sorts and putting his hand over her mouth. And it's very, it puts that tension and intimacy very in the forefront, and establishes that very quickly between the two characters. I should also note that the cat suit is also very subdued, very subtle ears on like the knit cap, so nothing like outlandish or anything that's very reminiscent almost of the Catwoman suit from The Dark Knight Rises. But I would say it's more grunge and fitting, because this is a very like grunge inspired style. Like they have Nirvana and they use Kurt Cobain as some of the influence or inspiration for Bruce's look outside of the Batsuit, with his longer hair and everything. I felt that the didn't make a huge amount of sense for like some of the more high-tech aspects of Selina's suit in The Dark Knight Rises, if she's supposed to be some sort of like pauper, like very poor person. I feel like the stuff that this Catwoman has is more feasible for someone of her economic status to like acquire and obtain and everything. And especially, I guess, suppose if she's flipping halls and everything like that, she could probably invest in some of like the safe drill and stuff like that that she's got. They end up going back to Selina's apartment where it's been ransacked, and after some interchange there, the Riddler shows us his second victim, the police commissioner, and it's heavily implied that there's a couple of rats in a like some sort of apparatus. Reminiscent of something you'd see in the movies Saw, in the Saw franchise, that his face is eaten off by rats, which is hella brutal. And again, we get another scene with Gordon and Batman, this time at the morgue, solving more of the Riddler's clues and stuff like that as it relates to the commissioner's death. And one of the quotes in this scene that really stood out to me, they're chatting about like how the commissioner was dirty and that perhaps Gordon didn't actually know who he was working with. And like, Batman's coming off very apathetic, and Gordon kind of picks up on that, and he's like, you make it sound like he had it coming. And Batman basically says, like, he was dirty, he's a cop that crossed the line, but he doesn't really refute that statement, so we get the implication that, the further implication that this crusade that Bruce is on may not be wholly for the correct reasons, and that perhaps he is very much in the opinion that he did have it coming, and that perhaps this morality that he eschews to is maybe just a guise to justify his actions, which I found to be very interesting, because I feel like a lot of the other Batman cinematic representations that we get are very much in the vein of wholly good for the right reasons. I mean, we get a little bit of this sort of gray Bruce Wayne at the start of Batman Begins, when he's takes the gun to court to shoot Joe Chill. But kind of after that, after his travels and everything like that, he comes to the morality of like, no, a life should not be taken, or that he will not take a life. And he commits to that code, and he's pretty much on the straight and narrow, doing everything for the right reason. From that point forward, we understand that he's trying to be an incorruptible symbol. This Batman, we don't necessarily get that feeling, or at least at this point. It's very much in line with how he introduces himself to the criminals as vengeance. He's there for a vendetta to avenge and revenge his family's death. I think even Robert Pattinson said in some of the behind the scenes and stuff like that, he's like, he gets the impression or he feels that Bruce goes out every night trying to recreate the circumstances of his like parents' death, essentially. Like, he just can't get past it. After that, we get some more Catwoman, Batman team up, where she gets one of the contact lenses and goes into the 40 below, which is like the club within the club of Iceberg Lounge. And we are introduced to the district attorney, Gil, who is basically as seedy and corrupted as the previous two Riddler victims. And what do you know? Gil makes apparent Riddler victim number 3 later on in the scene. And that cuts to a very rare public appearance by Bruce Wayne at the funeral of the mayor. Which I found interesting that Bruce is actually the one driving himself to the funeral, not a like personal driver or Alfred or something like that. And additionally, it's a freaking nice Corvette that he's driving. Backtracking a bit, because I just kind of scrolling through my notes here. One small detail that I did appreciate with the, because Gil, the district attorney, is assaulted in his vehicle outside of the Iceberg Lounge. He follows Selina out of the club after she leaves, because this is where we're introduced to John Turturro playing Falcone, and we get the impression that there's some history between them, which bothers Batman, which causes a rift between him and Catwoman, and then she storms out. So Gil kind of leaves to go after her, give her a ride home. She declines, so he goes back to his SUV, and he gets in, and he notices there's like condensation on his windshield, so he goes to wipe it away. Well, there's condensation on his windshield because the Riddler's in the back seat. Which I found a great small touch, because, like, yeah, if you've ever been in a car where it's maybe a little bit colder at night, because this is taking place in from Halloween through early November, yeah, it's gonna get some condensation. And then Gil notices that the headrest of his passenger front passenger seat is removed, and that is when he's assaulted. Cutting back to the funeral, Bruce sees a familiar set of like kind of black boots that lace up to like almost knee height. So he thinks that's Selina, and he starts to follow them. And he is stopped by Penguin and some other goons, because this person is with Falcone. And this is where we get to learn a little bit of backstory on Falcone and his connection to Wayne, the Wayne family. Now, I've never been a very big reader on the comics, but I know that in the animated series, there is a backstory element that Falcone was shot in the chest during some sort of gang altercation. I believe from the Maroni family, if I remember correctly. And that he ends up going to Thomas Wayne's house because he doesn't want to go to a hospital because of his notoriety and criminal history. So he goes to Thomas Wayne. Thomas Wayne operates on him on his kitchen table. They basically bring that in one for one into this. So I loved that they were using some of the animated series inspirations or storylines as inspiration, and actually just basically copying it event for event into this Batman's backstory, which was pretty cool. During this, we get the funeral for the mayor, which leads into a SUV barreling through this church, only to find that it's Gil Coulson, the district attorney with a bomb around his neck. And we get a little bit of a riddle game between the Riddler, Batman, and Coulson, and we get a better idea of what Riddler's vendetta or goal is. He's there to expose the corruption and those who participated in this corruption. Because his riddles relate to, like, feeling the violence of justice if it isn't properly meted out. Asking how much money Coulson is taking in order to not prosecute certain crimes. And then the last one, that Coulson refuses adamantly, is to give up who the rat or informant was that led to the Maroni drug bust, the largest drug bust in GCPD history, to that point, and he refuses, which ultimately results in the bomb detonating with Batman right next to it, which was a bit of a dumb decision on Batman's part. I didn't quite understand that. Felt a little bit weird to me, but whatever. We then get a scene where Batman is sort of captured. He's in like some sort of holding cell at the police department. And with a little bit of help and distraction of some sort, from Gordon, Batman is able to escape. And he runs and gets and grapples to the top of GCPD, and rather than having, like, his fancy, like, little nano cape from the Dark Knight films, he's got just, like, a straight, like, wingsuit that you'd see in, like, a skydiving video, which I thought was a really intriguing implementation of, like, gliding capability, only for Batman to make another really poor decision and try to deploy his parachute right as he's approaching a bridge and not expect that to, like, immediately go terribly wrong. And that finally leads us to the first look at the Batmobile. Gordon and Batman team up after this escape and locate a drug buy. They both go there, and things start to go south real quick as Catwoman appears, and a shootout ensues. After they also discover that Catwoman's friend has been unfortunately killed and has probably been dead this entire time that they've been looking for her. But we get to see the Batmobile, which is like this demonic, elemental, primal force been cobbled together out of vengeance and anger and scrap metal in the Batcave by Bruce. It's like, when it's powered on, it's got this like unearthly, like high-pitched squealing roar. And it's like breathing and coming to life, like it's ripping open a portal with like fire shooting out of its sides and out of its hood, and this blue white hot flame emitting out of its back. Sound design, production design, it's just great. And this car chase is pretty damn good. It ultimately culminates in, so it's a car chase between Batman and his car and the Penguin. Penguin creates a traffic accident in an effort to escape the Batman. Batman is able to jump out above it through a fireball. And this amazing shot from the side mirror of the Penguin's car, of the Batmobile, rather, leaping through the fire and landing, just like with flames kind of like licking off of it, helps to further add into that demonic, primal, unstoppable force. And Batman rams into Cobblepot's car, which throws it in the air, and it probably flips about like 6 or 7 times before hitting the ground and coming to a rest on its hood. And then you get this same slow walk from the Batmobile of Batman approaching with the fire behind him. So you just see the silhouette. And the camera's upside down because it's coming from Penguin's point of view. And it's just that of the horror monster finally catching you. And this leads to an interrogation between Batman and Gordon. And they figure out that the next location to go to is the old Wayne Manor, which was converted to an orphanage after Penguin helps them decipher a clue from earlier. I believe that clue was from the rat maze. There was a cipher that decoded was in Spanish of "You are el rata alata," which apparently translates to "rat with wings," which Batman immediately thinks is a pigeon. Or no, Alfred says it's slang for a pigeon, and then Bruce is like, "Oh, like a stool pigeon." That was probably the dumbest part of the clues and mystery. Like, really? You're like that dense? It's a bat. And they go through like different iterations, like, oh, maybe the Penguin's got wings, so maybe this Rata Alata is the Penguin. And like Penguin's like, no, your Spanish is terrible, it should be La Rata Alata. And then Batman's like, oh, maybe URL, like URL, like a website. So he goes to that and is able to, through a little chat with the Riddler, determine that the orphanage is next. And that Bruce was the next target, which results in Alfred getting injured. At this point, it was really like striking how much screen time Batman himself is getting. I feel like in a lot of other films, Batman films, a lot of the screen time is Bruce's time, and there's some like Batman highlights, but not like, I would say that at least 80% of this film is dedicated to Batman. Whether Batman is in his street clothes in hiding or in the actual bat suit, which is awesome. More Batman films need to be that. Batman and Selina meet back up, I believe, at the Bat Signal, and they start chatting about like what to do next. And Batman's kind of chiding her about like sacrificing her morals and everything like that just to get a payday. And she's like, this money is owed to me. He's like, oh, why do you think that? And he's like assuming the worst. And she comes out and says that, like, she's owed this money because Falcone is her dad and he killed her mom and basically doesn't know that she exists. And he's like, oh, damn. Like, I'm sorry that I, like, assumed the worst of you. Like, seeing him apologize was, like, not that it was, it's not common that you see like the hero apologize or something like that. I don't see it very, very often. But also during this, we learned that, Martha Wayne, his mother, was actually originally in Arkham, which I don't think there was any precedent for this in prior literature, or definitely not movies that I'm aware of. So that was actually kind of a unique twist to bring the Arkham name into the, into the fold. But the reasoning that Bruce was a target was that his dad, during his mayoral campaign, was trying to give some hush money to a journalist who had discovered that his mother was an Arkham, that there was a murder-suicide from her, I believe it was her parents. Her dad killed her mother and then killed himself. And that there was a bunch of money exchanged to hush that up, and that she's been in and out of institutions, which is like, okay. If she was in and out of institutions for, like, trauma, like, that makes sense. I don't see anything wrong with that. And, I mean, wealthy elite are always covering stuff up, so I get the idea. Like, Bruce is an orphan of great privilege. The Riddler, we learn, was an orphan of not so great privilege, so there's some resentment there. And that of the elite squandering the renewal fund that the Waynes set up for people like him. And it was very quickly squandered after Thomas and Martha's death. And that kind of brings us to Selina leaving after a disagreement with Bruce to the Iceberg Lounge to go confront Falcone and kill him. And we get one of, I would say, my favorite scene of the film. It's definitely the scene where they're just like, we are putting every single ounce of resource into it type thing. We get to the Iceberg Lounge. Selina's about to kill her dad, and then the power goes out. And Batman makes his way through to get to where Falcone and Selina are. And in doing so, he has to take an elevator, and there's this pitch black hallway. And this scene is just a fixed camera at the end of this hallway, pitch black, and the scene is only illuminated by the occasional flash of gunfire as Batman just eviscerates these goons and is taking rounds off the chest like a boss and just walking and beating them down. Only for him to capture Falcone, because he determines that a Falcone or Falcon also has wings. So he brings him out, and then the Riddler is finally able to take out Falcone, who turned out to be the informant in the Moroni drug bust. And then they began to pay off everyone involved to kind of keep everything going, get some money in their pockets, and move on. But that was a really, really awesome scene. And then this is where, on my initial watch, things started to get a little weird. Because they find the Riddler's apartment, essentially, with all of his manifestos and writings and ravings and everything. And then they essentially process the crime scene. They find, like, his little video chat with his followers, his alt-right followers, which I thought was a pretty unique and brave stance to basically make the rest of the villains as a whole, like, alt-right extremists in this film, which is weird to say, because, it was just interesting. This kind of leads to Bruce, or rather Batman, confronting the Riddler in Arkham Asylum. And they have an exchange where Riddler is going on about essentially his infatuation of, like, how he sees, like, a kindred spirit in the Batman, and how they failed to get their last target, Bruce Wayne. And basically it's holding a mirror up to Bruce, be like, this is kind of what you're doing. He's just got the drive or the lack of inhibitions to actually enact extreme life-ending violence on his targets, whereas Batman slash Bruce doesn't. He's got the morality or the inhibition or whatever you want to call it that's preventing him from doing so. Which leads to Batman just full-on rejecting the Riddler or Edward Nash, which just devastates him. It's like as if like a relationship of many years had been ended. And then he starts to kind of chide him, like, oh, you don't even know the half of what's going on. Which prompts Batman to go back to the apartment. Chatting with one of the officers, who at first I thought was like, the way he was acting, like rubbing his eyes, I thought he had taken like drops, which is like the drug of this world. But no, he didn't. I think it was just dark, or he might have been like napping. But they're chatting about like how the murder implement from the mayor crime scene was like a carpet puller, which prompts Batman to use it to pull up the carpet of the apartment, and he finds a map of Gotham with like specified points. And this, on first watch, is what confused me. Because this is actually where we kind of get an idea of the video. This is where Batman finds the video of like the manifesto, the final plan that Riddler's going to have his followers go to the, essentially, which is the induction ceremony of the new mayor, Ra's al, and basically kill her. Because, like, even though she might have good intentions, like, they basically just need to blow everything up and go from there. But they specifically targeted the seawall, because the idea with that is that the water floods the city and everyone's basically doomed, and the only real safe center is what they call Gotham Square Garden, which took me out of it a little bit. I was initially I'm like, oh, they're just basically one for one calling Gotham New York, which is whatever. I got over it really quickly. But at first I was like, well, okay, that kind of makes sense. Like, it forces that. They'll be all there, kind of congregated. It'll make it easier for his maniac followers to enact their vengeance or perverted justice. But like I said earlier, kind of coming back around full circle, it makes more sense on rewatches if you hone in on the fact that the seawall that they're blowing up was funded and created basically with Renewal, the Gotham Renewal Project, which is the kind of beating heart of this corruption that they take so many issues with. So with that in mind, it makes sense that they target that as a symbol that is, how did I put it, endemic to the Renewal Fund, or like to this corruption, as the face and the guise of public service that allows this corruption to continue. So by blowing that up, they're both like, they're blowing up the physical representation in the city of it, but also the idea that it can be continued to be used. So it made more sense after the fact. Otherwise, at first, it was a little hard to follow. Which leads to the final confrontation between the Riddler's crazy followers and Batman and his allies at the Gotham Square Garden. And this is where the final piece of the puzzle of the mirror being held up to Batman by the Riddler is finally set in place, where the final Riddler follower, when asked who he is, says that he is Vengeance. And that really kind of strikes it and sends it home to Bruce that he cannot do this out of vengeance and a place of ill repute. He has to do this for the right reasons. And that leads him to sacrificing himself to save the city, to shut down a transformer that is threatening the lives of everyone in the water, and then to become both a symbolic as well as, in that moment, a literal beacon of light leading them out of the darkness to salvation atop the Gotham Square Garden. And that's kind of where it ends. I mean, he and Catwoman have some dialogue together where she's trying to convince him to come with her to live a little bit more on the edge. But he decides not to. He's found his calling. He's found his reasoning to stay and to actually be able to start making a difference as a symbol of light in the darkness for the people of Gotham. And then it goes to credits. So yeah, like I was saying, for 3 hours, I feel like it's just very well paced. And with the amount of big name characters in this movie, the balancing act is done superbly. I mean, you've got Batman, you've got Catwoman, you've got Riddler, you've got Gordon, Penguin, Falcone, you've got Alfred, you've got, like, big names from the Batman mythos, and it doesn't feel like anyone is shoehorned in, or that one is shortchanged in some manner. Maybe to an extent, Alfred gets a little bit of the short end of the stick, just because he doesn't have, I mean, and even then, not so much. He's like a very emotional core to Batman and his connection to his past, and is actually what kind of brings Batman back around to, like, reason after he learns the dark secrets of his family, and he confronts Falcone about it, and Falcone's like, yeah, like, your dad had me do this. But I think that he basically blames their death on Maroni, and Alfred's like, no, your dad didn't know that Falcone was going to kill these people, and basically he was like, I'm going to go to the police and turn this all in and tell them what happened, and then Falcone was like, nah, that didn't happen, and then killed him. So, like, all the main characters are, like, very well balanced, and no one is, like, given an undue shortage or is in any way just shoehorned in to fill out the cast, or just to hit a character quota. But yeah, overall, cinematography was wonderful, dialogue was great, music was impactful, and it really enhanced the atmosphere. I cannot wait to see what they do with the sequel. And I know that there's some spin-offs with mostly regards to the Penguin that are supposed to be coming out. But, like, how they build on top of this already kind of, like, what seems to be an established world, and we're kind of jumping in midway, is quite exciting to me, based on, like, previous installments that have been less successful. I've always preferred the more intimate smaller stakes sort of issues and villains, not so much the we've got to fight this universe-ending evil, otherwise we lose type thing. Like, yeah, that makes for some epic moments, and it's got its places, but I prefer the more confined scenarios like these. Just, it's able to better explore the characters, in my opinion, than the big epics can. Big epics are great as a culmination of many movies and many years of work, but these standalone films need to be intimate character studies as to what motivates and drives these characters, and I think they did a great job. The most annoying thing that I found in the film was, like I mentioned earlier, the Rata Alata clue, and how quickly they were just, or like how steadfast they were in just like honing in on a pigeon, how tunnel visioned they were, like very antithetical to what a good detective should be. Like, it's like Alfred's like, oh, I mean, it's loosely translated to URL Rata Alata, which is slang for pigeon. And then Bruce is like a stool pigeon. And then Gordon doesn't really think anything of it. He's like, yeah, like a pigeon. Just kind of goes along for the ride with it. And it's not until they like are interrogating Penguin, he's like, are you like both that dumb? Is your Spanish that like bad? Granted, I'm not well versed in Spanish. I know very little of the basics. So like, and I even generally get the idea between the L versus La and the gendered wording and stuff like that. Like, generally speaking, words ending in A will have La preceding it versus L. Or not gendered, masculine versus feminine words. But I like really wasn't paying much attention to that. And I'm like, oh yeah, when Penguin brought it up, I'm like, yeah, like that is bad. And he's like, you know what else is a rat with wings? A bat. Did you think about that? He's like basically screaming it to him, and they're like, kind of just disregard it. And they're like, nah, we think it's, now it's a penguin. And then ultimately a falcon. It's like, come on, guys. You can do better than that. That was one of the only things that really annoyed me. And like, that's minor, but it just made them look like fools, was my biggest thing. But all in all, definitely recommend watching it. I personally give it a rating of a 9 out of 10. Fantastic film, especially considering it was done basically through the height of COVID. Great cinematography, great score, just great atmosphere. I cannot wait to see what they do with this in the sequels and future. So anyways, I appreciate everyone for joining me again for this movie review, and hopefully I can start making this a more regular, like, maybe a monthly or a bi-weekly type of thing. But we'll kind of play that by ear and see where that takes us. Until next time, everyone, have a wonderful time and a wonderful day.